stalwart and straight, he was ideal in every respect. His face was that of a rishi, as described in the ancient texts. Noble-headed, abundantly bearded, he always sat firmly upright, his quiet eyes fixed on omnipresence. The saint and I entered the meditative state. After an hour, his gentle voice roused me. "You go often into the silence, but have you developed a new bhava?" He was reminding me to love God more than meditation. "Do not mistake the technique for the goal." He offered me some mangoes. With that good-humored wit that I found so delightful in his grave nature, he remarked, "People in general are more fond of Jala Yoga union with food, than of Dhyana Yoga union with God." His yogic pun affected me uproariously. "What a laugh you have." An affectionate gleam came into his gaze. His own face was always serious, yet touched with an ecstatic smile. His large, lotus eyes held a hidden divine laughter. "Those letters come from far off America." The sage indicated several thick envelopes on a table. "I correspond with a few societies there whose members are interested in yoga. They are discovering India anew, with a better sense of direction than Columbus. I am glad to help them. The knowledge of yoga is free to all who will receive, like the ungarnishable daylight." Bhaduri Mahasaya. The levitating saint. "Sir," I inquired, "why do you not write a book on yoga for the benefit of the world?" "I am training disciples," he replied. "They and their students will be living volumes, proof against the natural disintegrations of time and the unnatural interpretations of the critics. What rishis perceived as essential for human salvation need not be diluted for the West. Alike in soul though diverse in outer experience, neither West nor East will flourish if some form of disciplinary yoga be not practiced." The saint held me with his tranquil eyes. I did not realize that his speech was a veiled prophetic guidance. It is only now, as I write these words, that I understand the full meaning in the casual intimations he often gave me that someday I would carry India's teachings to America. "Maharishi, I wish you would write a book on yoga for the benefit of the world. I am training disciples. They and their students will be living volumes, proof against the natural disintegrations of time and the unnatural interpretations of the critics." Bhaduri's wit put me into another gale of laughter. I remained alone with the yogi until his disciples arrived in the evening. Bhaduri Mahasaya entered one of his inimitable discourses. Like a peaceful flood, he swept away the mental debris of his listeners, floating them Godward. His striking parables were expressed in a flawless Bengali. This evening Bhaduri expounded various philosophical points connected with the life of Mirabai, a medieval Rajputani princess who abandoned her court life to seek the company of sadhus. One great sannyasi refused to receive her because she was a woman. Her reply brought him humbly to her feet. "Tell the master," she had said, "that I did not know there was any male in the universe save God. Are we all not females before him?" A scriptural conception of the Lord as the only positive creative principle, his creation being naught but a passive maya. Mirabai composed many ecstatic songs which are still treasured in India. I translate one of them here. "If by bailing daily God could be realized, sooner would I be a whale in the deep. If by eating roots and fruits he could be known, gladly would I choose the form of a goat. If the counting of rosaries uncovered him, I would say my prayers on mammoth beads. If bowing before stone images unveiled him a flinty mountain I would humbly worship. If by drinking milk the Lord could be imbibed many calves and children would know him. If abandoning one's wife would summon God would not thousands be eunuchs?" Mirabai knows that to find the divine one the only indispensable is love. Several students put rupees in Bhaduri's slippers which lay by his side as he sat in yoga posture. This respectful offering, customary in India, indicates that the disciple places his material goods at the guru's feet. Grateful friends are only the Lord in disguise, looking after his own. "Master, you are wonderful." A student, taking his leave, gazed ardently at the patriarchal sage. "You have renounced riches and comforts to seek God and teach us wisdom. It was well known that Bhaduri Mahasaya had forsaken great family wealth in his early childhood, when single-mindedly he entered the yogic path. You are reversing the case. The saint's face held a mild rebuke. I have left a few paltry rupees, a few petty pleasures, for a cosmic empire of endless bliss. How then have I denied myself anything? I know the joy of sharing the treasure. Is that a sacrifice? The short-sighted worldly folk are verily the real renunciates. They relinquish an unparalleled divine possession for a poor handful of earthly toys. I chuckled over this paradoxical view of renunciation, one which puts the cap of Croesus on any saintly beggar, whilst transforming all proud millionaires into unconscious martyrs. The divine order arranges our future more wisely than any insurance company. The master's concluding words were the realized greed of his faith. The world is full of uneasy believers in an outward security. Their bitter thoughts are like scars on their foreheads. The one who gave us air and milk from our first breath knows how to provide day by day for his devotees. I continued my after-school pilgrimages to the saint's door. With silent zeal he aided me to attain a new bhava. One day he moved to Randmohan Roy Road, away from there, the levitating saint, neighborhood of my Gupta Road home. His loving disciples had built him a new hermitage, known as Nagendramath. Although it throws me ahead of my story by a number of years, I will recount here the last words given to me by Bhaduri Mahasaya. Shortly before I embarked for the West, I sought him out and humbly knelt for his farewell blessing. Son, go to America. Take the dignity of hoary India for your shield. Victory is written on your brow, the noble distant people will well receive you. Chapter 8. India's Great Scientist, J. C. Bose. Overhearing this provocative remark, I walked closer to a sidewalk group of professors engaged in scientific discussion. If my motive in joining them was racial pride, I regret it. I cannot deny my keen interest in evidence that India can play a leading part in physics, and not metaphysics alone. What do you mean, sir? The professor obligingly explained. Bose was the first one to invent a wireless coherer and an instrument for indicating the refraction of electric waves. But the Indian scientist did not exploit his inventions commercially. He soon turned his attention from the inorganic to the organic world. His revolutionary discoveries as a plant physiologist are outpacing even his radical achievements as a physicist. I politely thanked my mentor. He added, "The great scientist is one of my brother professors at Presidency College." I paid a visit the next day to the sage at his home, which was close to mine on Gupta Road. I had long admired him from a respectful distance. The grave and retiring botanist greeted me graciously. He was a handsome, robust man in his 50s, with thick hair, broad forehead, and the abstracted eyes of a dreamer. The precision in his tones revealed the lifelong scientific habit. I have recently returned from an expedition to scientific societies of the West. Their members exhibited intense interest in delicate instruments of my invention which, 70, Jagadish Chandra Bose, demonstrate the indivisible unity of all life. The Bose crescograph has the enormity of 10 million magnifications. The microscope enlarges only a few thousand times, yet it brought vital impetus to biological science. The crescograph opens incalculable vistas. You have done much, sir, to hasten the embrace of East and West in the impersonal arms of science. I was educated at Cambridge. How admirable is the Western method of submitting all theory to scrupulous experimental verification. That empirical procedure has gone hand in hand with the gift for introspection which is my Eastern heritage. Together they have enabled me to sunder the silences of natural realms long uncommunicative. The telltale charts of my crescograph are evidence for the most skeptical that plants have a sensitive nervous system and a varied emotional life. Love, hate, joy, fear, pleasure, pain, excitability, stupor, and countless appropriate responses to stimuli are as universal in plants as in animals. The unique throb of life in all creation could seem only poetic imagery before your advent, Professor. A saint I once knew would never pluck flowers. Shall I rob the rose bush of its pride and beauty? Shall I cruelly affront its dignity by my rude divestment? His sympathetic words are verified literally through your discoveries. The poet is intimate with truth, while the scientist approaches awkwardly. Come someday to my laboratory and see the unequivocal testimony of the crescograph. Gratefully I accepted the invitation, and took my departure. I heard later that the botanist had left Presidency College, and was planning a research center in Calcutta. When the Bose Institute was opened, I attended the dedicatory services. Enthusiastic hundreds strolled over the premises. I was charmed with the artistry and spiritual symbolism of the new home of science. Its front gate, I noted, was a century-old relic from a distant shrine. Behind the lotus fountain, a sculptured female figure with a torch conveyed the Indian respect for woman as the immortal light-bearer. The garden held a small temple consecrated to the noumen and beyond phenomena. Thought of the divine incorporeity was suggested by absence of any altar image. Bose's speech on this great occasion might have issued from the lips of one of the inspired ancient rishis. I dedicate today this institute as not merely a laboratory but a temple. His reverent solemnity stole like an unseen cloak over the crowded auditorium. In the pursuit of my investigations, I was unconsciously led into the border region of physics and physiology. To my amazement, I found boundary lines vanishing, and points of contact emerging, between the realms of the living and the non-living. Inorganic matter was perceived as anything but inert. It was a thrill under the action of multitudinous forces. A universal reaction seemed to bring metal, plant and animal under a common law. They all exhibited essentially the same phenomena of fatigue and depression, with possibilities of recovery and of exaltation, as well as the permanent irresponsiveness associated with death. Filled with awe at this stupendous generalization, it was with great hope that I announced my results before the Royal Society results demonstrated by experiments. But the physiologists present advised me to confine myself to physical investigations, in which my success had been assured, rather than encroach on their preserves. I had unwittingly strayed into the domain of an unfamiliar caste system and so offended its etiquette. An unconscious theological bias was also present, which confounds ignorance with faith. It is often forgotten that he who surrounded us with this ever-evolving mystery of creation has also implanted in us the desire to question and understand. Through many years of miscomprehension, I came to know that the life of a devotee of science is inevitably filled with unending struggle. It is for him to cast his life as an ardent offering regarding gain and loss, success and failure, as one. In time, the leading scientific societies of the world accepted my theories and results, and recognized the importance of the Indian contribution to science. Can anything small or circumscribed ever satisfy the mind of India? By a continuous living tradition, and a vital power of rejuvenescence, this land has readjusted itself through unnumbered transformations. Indians have always arisen who, discarding the immediate and absorbing prize of the hour, have sought for the realization of the highest ideals in life not through passive renunciation, but through active struggle. The weakling who has refused the conflict, acquiring nothing, has had nothing to renounce. He alone who has striven and won can enrich the world by bestowing the fruits of his victorious experience. The work already carried out in the Bose laboratory on the response of matter, and the unexpected revelations in plant life, have opened out very extended regions of inquiry in physics, in physiology, in medicine, in agriculture, and even in psychology. Problems hitherto regarded as insoluble have now been brought within the sphere of experimental investigation. But high success is not to be obtained without rigid exactitude. Hence the long battery of supersensitive instruments and apparatus of my design, which stand before you today in their cases in the entrance hall. They tell you of the protracted efforts to get behind the deceptive seeming into, at present, only the sheerest accident brings India into the purview of the American college student. 8 universities, Harvard, Yale, Columbia, Princeton, Johns Hopkins, Pennsylvania, Chicago, and California, have chairs of Indology or Sanskrit, but India is virtually unrepresented in departments of history, philosophy, fine arts, political science, sociology, or any of the other departments of intellectual experience in which, as we have seen, India has made great contributions. We believe, consequently, that no department of study, particularly in the humanities, in any major university can be fully equipped without a properly trained specialist in the Indic phases of its discipline. We believe, too, that every college which aims to prepare its graduates for intelligent work in the world which is to be theirs to live in, must have on its staff a scholar competent in the civilization of India. The lectures given here will not be mere repetitions of second-hand knowledge. They will announce new discoveries, demonstrated for the first time in these halls. Through regular publication of the work of the Institute, these Indian contributions will reach the whole world. They will become public property. No patents will ever be taken. The spirit of our national culture demands that we should forever be free from the desecration of utilizing knowledge only for personal gain. It is my further wish that the facilities of this Institute be available, so far as possible, to workers from all countries. In this I am attempting to carry on the traditions of my country. So far back as 25 centuries, India welcomed to its ancient universities, at Nalanda and Tuxla, scholars from all parts of the world. Although science is neither of the East nor of the West but rather international in its universality, yet India is specially fitted to make great contributions. The burning Indian imagination, which can extort new order out of a mass of apparently contradictory facts, is held in check by the habit of concentration. This restraint confers the power to hold the mind to the pursuit of truth with an infinite patience. Tears stood in my eyes at the scientist's concluding words. Is patience not indeed a synonym of India, confounding time and the historians alike? I visited the research center again, soon after the day of opening. The great botanist, mindful of his promise, took me to his quiet laboratory. I will attach the crescograph to this fern, the magnification is tremendous. If a snail's crawl were enlarged in the same proportion, the creature would appear to be traveling like an express train. My gaze was fixed eagerly on the screen which reflected the magnified fern shadow. Minute life movements were now clearly perceptible. The plant was growing very slowly before my fascinated eyes. The scientist touched the tip of the fern with a small metal bar. The developing pantomime came to an abrupt halt, resuming the eloquent rhythms as soon as the rod was withdrawn. You saw how any slight outside interference is detrimental to the sensitive tissues, Bose remarked. Watch, I will now administer chloroform, and then give an antidote. The effect of the chloroform discontinued all growth. The antidote was revivifying. The evolutionary gestures on the screen held me more aptly than a movie plot. My companion here in the role of villain, thrust a sharp instrument through a part of the fern, pain was indicated by spasmodic flutters. When he passed a razor partially through the stem, the shadow was violently agitated, then stilled itself with the final punctuation of death. By first chloroforming a huge tree, I achieved a successful transplantation. Usually, such monarchs of the forest die very quickly after being moved. Jagadis smiled happily as he recounted the life-saving maneuver. Grafts of Mai. The atomic structure of matter was well known to the ancient Hindus. One of the six systems of Indian philosophy is Vaisika, from the Sanskrit root Vaisas, atomic individuality. One of the foremost Vaisika expounders was Aulakya, also called Kanada, the atom eater, born about 2,800 years ago. In an article in East-West, April, 1934, a summary of Vaisika scientific knowledge was given as follows: though the modern atomic theory is generally considered a new advance of science, it was brilliantly expounded long ago by Kanada, the atom eater. The Sanskrit anus can be properly translated as atom in the latter's literal Greek sense of uncut or indivisible. Other scientific expositions of Vaisika treatises of the BC era include, 1. The movement of needles toward magnets, 2. The circulation of water in plants, 3. Akashic ether, inert and structureless, as a basis for transmitting subtle forces. 4. The solar fire as the cause of all other forms of heat. 5. Heat as the cause of molecular change. 6. The law of gravitation as caused by the quality that inheres in Earth atoms to give them their attractive power or downward pull. 7. The kinetic nature of all energy, causation as always rooted in an expenditure of energy or a redistribution of motion. 8. Universal dissolution through the disintegration of atoms. 9. The radiation of heat and light rays, infinitely small particles, darting forth in all directions with inconceivable speed, the modern cosmic rays theory. 10. The relativity of time and space. The great scientist pointed to another Bose instrument. I will show you experiments on a piece of tin. The life force in metals responds adversely or beneficially to stimuli. Ink markings will register the various reactions. Deeply engrossed, I watched the graph which recorded the characteristic waves of atomic structure. When the professor applied chloroform to the tin, the vibratory writings stopped. They recommenced as the metal slowly regained its normal state. My companion dispensed a poisonous chemical. Simultaneous with the quivering end of the tin, the needle dramatically wrote on the chart a death notice. Bose instruments have demonstrated that metals, such as the steel used in scissors and machinery, are subject to fatigue, and regain efficiency by periodic rest. The life pulse in metals is seriously harmed or even extinguished through the application of electric currents or heavy pressure. I looked around the room at the numerous inventions, eloquent testimony of a tireless ingenuity. Sir, it is lamentable that mass agricultural development is not speeded by fuller use of your marvelous mechanisms. Would it not be easily possible to employ some of them in quick laboratory experiments to indicate the influence of various types of fertilizers on plant growth? You are right. Countless uses of Bose instruments will be made by future generations. The scientist seldom knows contemporaneous reward. It is enough to possess the joy of creative service. With expressions of unreserved gratitude to the indefatigable sage, I took my leave. Can the astonishing fertility of his genius ever be exhausted? I thought. No diminution came with the years. Inventing an intricate instrument, the resonant cardiograph, Bose then pursued extensive researches on innumerable Indian plants. An enormous unsuspected pharmacopoeia of useful drugs was revealed. The cardiograph is constructed with an unerring accuracy by which a 100th part of a second is indicated on a graph. Resonant records measure infinitesimal pulsations in plant, animal and human structure. The great botanist predicted that use of his cardiograph will lead to vivisection on plants instead of animals. Side-by-side recordings of the effects of a medicine given simultaneously to a plant and an animal have shown astounding unanimity in result, he pointed out. Everything in man has been foreshadowed in the plant. Experimentation on vegetation will contribute to lessening of human suffering. Years later, Bose's pioneer plant findings were substantiated by other scientists. Work done in 1938 at Columbia University was reported by the New York Times as follows. It has been determined within the past few years that when the nerves transmit messages between the brain and other parts of the body, tiny electrical impulses are being generated. These impulses have been measured by delicate galvanometers and magnified millions of times by modern amplifying apparatus. Until now, no satisfactory method had been found to study the passages of the impulses along the nerve fibers in living animals or man because of the great speed with which these impulses travel. DRS. K. S. Cole and H. J. Curtis reported having discovered that the long single cells of the freshwater plant Nitella, used frequently in goldfish bowls, are virtually identical with those of single nerve fibers. Furthermore, they found that Nitella fibers, on being excited, propagate electrical waves that are similar in every way, except velocity, to those of the nerve fibers in animals and man. The electrical nerve impulses in the plant were found to be much slower than those in animals. This discovery was therefore seized upon by the Columbia workers as a means for taking slow-motion pictures of the passage of the electrical impulses in nerves. The Nitella plant thus may become a sort of Rosetta Stone for deciphering the closely guarded secrets close to the very borderland, Jagadish Chandra Bose, of mind and matter. The poet Rabindranath Tagore was a stalwart friend of India's idealistic scientist. To him, the sweet Bengali singer addressed the following lines: "O hermit, call thou in the authentic words of that old hymn called Sama, rise. Awake. Call to the man who boasts his Shastra claw from vain pedantic wranglings profitless. Call to that foolish bragger to come forth out on the face of nature, this broad earth. Send forth this call unto thy scholar band, together round thy sacrifice of fire let them all gather. So may our India, our ancient land unto herself return, oh once again return to steadfast work, to duty and devotion, to her trance of earnest meditation. Let her sit once more unruffled, greedless, strifeless, pure, oh once again upon her lofty seat and platform, teacher of all lands." Chapter 9. Silently I had entered the room in great awe. The angelic appearance of Master Mahasaya fairly dazzled me. With silky white beard and large lustrous eyes, he seemed an incarnation of purity. His upraised chin and folded hands surprised me that my first visit had disturbed him in the midst of his devotions. His simple words of greeting produced the most violent effect my nature had so far experienced. The bitter separation of my mother's death I had thought the measure of all anguish. Now an agony at separation from my divine mother was an indescribable torture of the spirit. I fell moaning to the floor. "Little sir, quiet yourself." The saint was sympathetically distressed. Abandoned in some oceanic desolation, I clutched his feet as the sole raft of my rescue. "Holy sir, thy intercession. Ask Divine Mother if I find any favor in her sight. This promise is one not easily bestowed," the master was constrained to silence. Beyond reach of doubt, I was convinced that Master Mahasaya was in intimate converse with the Universal Mother. It was deep humiliation to realize that my eyes were blind to her who even at this moment was perceptible to the faultless gaze of the saint. Shamelessly gripping his feet, deaf to his gentle remonstrances, I besought him again and again for his intervening grace. "I will make your plea to the beloved." The master's capitulation came with a slow, compassionate smile. What power in those few words, that my being should know release from its stormy exile. "Sir, remember your pledge. I shall return soon for her message." Joyful anticipation rang in my voice that only a moment ago had been sobbing in sorrow. Descending the long stairway, I was overwhelmed by memories. This house at 50 Amherst Street, now the residence of Master Mahasaya, had once been my family home, scene of my mother's death. Here my human heart had broken for the vanished mother, and here today my spirit had been as though crucified by absence of the Divine Mother. Hallowed walls, silent witness of my grievous hurts and final healing. My steps were eager as I returned to my Gupta Road home. Seeking the seclusion of my small attic, I remained in meditation until 10 o'clock. The darkness of the warm Indian night was suddenly lit with a wondrous vision. Hallowed in splendor, the Divine Mother stood before me. Her face, tenderly smiling, was beauty itself. "Always have I loved thee. Ever shall I love thee." The celestial tones still ringing in the air, she disappeared. The sun on the following morning had hardly risen to an angle of decorum when I paid my second visit to Master Mahasaya. Climbing the staircase in the house of poignant memories, I reached his fourth floor room. The knob of the closed door was wrapped around with a cloth, a hint, I felt, that the saint desired privacy. As I stood irresolutely on the landing, the door was opened by the master's welcoming hand. I knelt at his holy feet. In a playful mood, I wore a solemn mask over my face, hiding the divine elation. "Sir, I have come very early, I confess!" exclamation mark for your message. "Did the beloved mother say anything about me?" "Mischievous little sir. Not another remark would he make." Apparently my assumed gravity was unimpressive. Why so mysterious, so evasive? Do saints never speak plainly? Perhaps I was a little provoked. Must you test me? His calm eyes were full of understanding. Could I add a single word this morning to the assurance you received last night at 10 o'clock from the beautiful mother herself?